Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I am the Director of Digital Services at Eastwick Communications, and every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. Today, on this cool Bay Area day, I have the pleasure of welcoming Harry McCracken of Technologizer. Hello, Harry.
Hey there, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Just fine, thanks.
Yeah, we know you're getting over the flu and appreciate so much for you pinch hitting for a guest that we had to reschedule. So I thank you so much for that.
It's great to be here.
and we talk about the topic of influence and how the media landscape has changed. And what I think is so interesting about having you on the show is your journey. And the fact that you left PC World to start, what was at the time probably a pretty brave move to start Technologizer. Can you tell us a little bit about what drove that decision, what was going on in your mind at the time, and maybe the market forces and other things that made it clear or maybe a leap of faith to do what you did?
Sure. Well, I had worked at PC World for about 13 and a half years and really enjoyed almost every moment of it. But I really thought about the fact that, you know, we are in a unique period for journalists in that, a one-man site can have equal access to the web and can be just as efficient as reaching readers as the largest media companies in the world, which is kind of a radically new idea, given that if I had, had a similar desire 15 years ago, I could not have announced I was starting a magazine without considerable financial backing and thinking about, magazine printing presses and trucks delivering magazines around the country and all kinds of stuff that really do require a large company. But I can get on the web really easily. Most of the tools I need to do that are either very inexpensive or free in a lot of cases. And as much as I like PC World, it thrived before I got there. It's doing just fine without me. And I thought it was an interesting opportunity to try to create a new brand from scratch.
And so the listeners that may not be familiar with the timing, what years are we talking about here?
Well, I started at PC World in late 1994, which was an interesting time because it was sort of when the web was just taking off.
Mm-hmm.
And I left almost exactly a year ago. It was a year ago this week.
Wow. And since then, PC World has gone to online only.
No, PC World is the last magazine standing. PC Magazine and Computer Shopper, which were the two major competitors we had left in print when I left, and they've both gone online only. But PC World is actually not only still in print, it's actually doing quite well in print.
Oh, okay. So thank you for correcting me. I thought that I have to correct myself to my husband, too, because he was looking to subscribe, and I thought that they had gone digital only. But
it's still around. I mean, part of when I was there, one of our major goals was to try to make a website that was really good and could be really successful, but also to preserve the magazine and not give up on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the strategy worked pretty well because the magazine is actually, hanging in there and doing quite well.
Great. What do you make of the fact that so many of the magazines that are doing well seem to be English, or I should say from another country? So if you look at circulation rates like The Economist, especially Business Pub, so The Economist, Financial Times, they're seeing increases in, subscription rates and people actually wanting the hard copies of them. Wired had a jump and then it's kind of gone down. Fast Company is doing well. What do you kind of make of this idea, though, that, some of the news that's, driving at least the business press and is, that definitely Silicon Valley companies care about is actually out of our country?
Well, I think it's partially just that the publications you mentioned are good, and most of the magazines that will continue to do okay are the ones that are worth paying money for. With the UK specifically, it's also true. If you go to Borders or Barnes & Noble and look in the computer magazine section, almost everything except for PC World and a few others are actually from the UK. And I think that's partially because the US has moved more quickly to go online. But just about everybody I know who works in the media in the UK feels like the same things that happened here in terms of readers really going online quickly will happen there. It's just taking a little bit longer to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I think ultimately a lot of it is a magazine like The Economist is really good, and people will happily pay for it. And it tends to be the publications that weren't quite as strong editorially that have disappeared the most quickly.
And let's talk a little bit about the editorial focus of your successful venture that is Technologizer. Where did you decide, because one of the things I love about the site is the organization is very clear. You make slideshows out of interesting topics that you wouldn't expect necessarily to be visual, so you present them in a really easy-to-consume manner. So as I'm eating my lunch, I can run through the site very, very easily if I'm actually on the site rather than the RSS. I think that sidebar that you have where there's, the one I was reading earlier today was what did you call it? The biggest fights that have been around, that continue to linger.
Oh, yeah.
You made that into a slideshow, and I, I'm sitting reading it and half laughing, half knowing that these are very real realities. But, it made me think, this is, you've clearly got this, finger on the pulse of a number of different things. And so I was just wondering in terms of, myself coming from an editorial background, what you see sort of the editorial focus of Technologizer being, because it does represent so many different kinds of coverage to different people.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that changed when I left PC World is as much as PC World changed with the times, when you have a PC in the name, that does to some extent define where your focus was going to be. And I looked at the fact that a lot of the most exciting stuff happening in technology these days is happening on the web and happening with phones. And so when I chose the name Technologizer, I chose that partially because I wanted a fairly broad name that could encompass multiple things. And in terms of the topics we cover, there are really four of them. And in rough order of importance, they're the web, mobile phones, which are really sort of becoming the PCs of today,
mm-hmm.
consumer electronics, and then PCs and Macs. And a lot of the best stories we cover are the ones that span two or more of those worlds because when nobody was looking, convergence really did happen, and these are not four separate categories anymore. It's really one big world.
Absolutely. So in terms of all of the world of the web and all, there's, one of the things, in terms of looking at things from a strategic perspective that can be a little bit frustrating is this focus on tools, right, as, people coming out with strategies that are completely tool-focused, especially I get very nervous when it's companies like Twitter that don't have a public, at least, business plan, so you don't know really if you can scale the project or the identity of a particular company. So you find that it's happening with the bigger brands making these leaps into saying, okay, Facebook is my presence on the web now. I don't need a corporate website. What is your take on these tool-based strategies, or do you see it a different way?
Well, I think it's ultimately not an either-or situation. I think it's valuable to be everywhere that people who might be interested in you may look for you. And so with my site, Twitter turned out to be a fairly significant part of how people find me. We're also on Facebook. I really think it's you kind of need to go where the people are who are going to be interested in you, and luckily it's not a huge undertaking to be on Twitter. It's not a huge deal to be on Facebook. You don't need to invest in something that needs to be around for the next 5 to 10 years to be successful. And
mm-hmm.
if Twitter turns out to be something that's not around 2 or 3 years from now, that's kind of fine. But right now it's I think it's an important place to be.
So you mentioned Twitter being important, and I've got a collection of staff questions. In fact, my first question is partly motivated by Lita in our office, and she had another question for you, which is, really related to what we're talking about here in terms of the tool that is Twitter. What do you see as the three or so key benefits of using Twitter for your purposes?
Well, I mean, I kind of look at Twitter for me as being just a communications method in the way that magazines are and websites are, just in very small chunks, and I can do it fairly easily. And it's a way to reach millions of people. And sometimes on there I share things that are not worth doing a blog post. I mean, all kinds of interesting stuff relating to technology happens to me all day long, and a lot of it is not worth writing about, even, you know, 200 or 300 words. And I share that with people on Twitter. I also promote stories on Technologizer on Twitter, and people, you know, cheerfully discover those on Twitter and click through to read them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are an awful lot of smart people on Twitter. I find the people I'm reaching on Twitter are the kind of people who I want to be Technologizer readers, and it just is not a huge investment of time on my part either.
Mm-hmm.
But I ultimately look at it as sort of another media that I do as a journalist. I don't talk much about personal stuff. For the most part, I'm not talking with friends and family on Twitter. I'm really trying to reach out to a larger audience.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. You know, that sort of brings up how you use Twitter. So going through your Twitter feed, what would I find the way? Are you using it from the web? Or are you using it from your phone? Or are you using it from all of those methods?
You know, it's a little embarrassing to admit, when I do it on my computer, I still generally do it on Twitter.com, which in theory is a sign I'm a clueless newbie, but it's really simple and it does the job. And I also like to be able to dart in and out of Twitter. And, you know, tools like TweetDeck are cool, but they sort of consume your computer, and I just want to jump in and out. And when I'm out and about, I usually do it on my iPhone, and on that I use Tweety, which is my favorite iPhone Twitter client.
Cool. Yeah, we like hearing about the favorites of people. Being a BlackBerry user, I'm pretty much stuck with TwitterBerry, but that's not such a bad thing.
Actually, you aren't. There's a new client for the BlackBerry called Uber Twitter, and all the BlackBerry folks I know say it's way better than TwitterBerry.
Yeah, I have somebody I know that's so I have, you know, people that, you know, as we all do, that, you know, you kind of rely on to kind of try things out. So I'm waiting to see what their review is for me before I make the jump, because I'm so addicted to TwitterBerry. So, you know, in terms of mobile devices, touching on that topic, and knowing that it's, I mean, clearly the media and every other, you know, information resource, whether I think it's video delivery for entertainment purposes or news or whatever, you know, you touched on this a little bit, but I think, you know, having been a member of the media for a very long time, in new media for more than 10 years at broadcast networks, I've been saying, you know, for at least the last 5 years, we have to think about going where the consumer is. It doesn't really, they're not going to care. They're going to be pretty platform agnostic in terms of, you know, what our limitations are, but you can't just have a website anymore, right? You have to have multiple distribution channels so that you have some sort of mobile strategy, have some sort of even gaming unit strategy for some people, for those that have media servers in their homes especially. And as more products come out that are easy, you know, where do you really see the trends lying in terms of distribution formats? I know you're saying mobile is something that you're very committed to. Do you have any thoughts on the idea that, you know, where, you know, about how to make what you're doing available everywhere, wherever the consumer wants it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think mobile phones really are the biggest coming sea change. I mean, these things really are PCs, and we're just at the very start of the phone revolution.
Mm-hmm.
To me, phones like the iPhone and Android phones and the Palm Pre are sort of where PCs were in about 1983, when they were pretty cool, but most of the innovation was yet to come. In terms of how people use phones for distribution, I think a lot of that is yet to be determined. But we are seeing, you know, some pretty sophisticated applications on the iPhone for consuming content. I think you'll see a lot of that. I mean, as you see the browsers on phones get better, Media companies are going to have to do less customization. You probably are not going to see a lot of people wanting to read 3,000-word-long reviews of 20 products on a phone. So we will have to write shorter and punchier, although I do have the feeling that people will end up actually being willing to read more on phones than some people think they will right now. I think another thing which is probably going to happen are our devices, which are sort of tablet-like devices, and some of them might be dedicated reading devices like the Kindle. Other of them might be more general purpose, and they're going to be smaller than a laptop and easier to tote around and maybe a better battery life. For the longest time, these devices didn't really happen because the world revolved around PCs and primarily around PCs that ran Windows. And that's just less so today because the world revolves around the web, and it's way easier to build devices of all kinds that run different operating systems that can all be equal citizens on the web. And I think you'll see some of that happen. And netbooks becoming popular is sort of one early sign of that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, my mom has a little Acer micro laptop that she adores. She loves that thing.
My mom, too.
Yeah, totally gotten rid of, you know, basically doesn't use her old HP laptop and is, you know, bought it at, you know, kind of on a whim at Costco one day, and there you have it, you know, the Costco effect in full form. So, you know, I think that's interesting too. And I'm constantly thinking about, you know, the sort of the psychology and the generations that of people that are involved in the consumption of media and how they're influenced. And we know that, you know, however we define these generations, we know the millennials, whether you think they're born after 82 or after 81 or whatever the definition is of the age, you know, of the actual where it begins piece of it, we know that their behavioral patterns are very different, whereas you have, you know, like our moms are probably baby boomers or in that category. And they're still an important piece of the buying spectrum, so, of course, still targeted. What demographic are you really catering to on Technologizer? How much does that factor into what kinds of stories you're writing, whether it's gender or age or income level, any of those kinds of things? Or is it even factoring in?
You know, I... My goal is to write for a particular kind of person who, in some cases, these people are 50, in some cases they're 25, in some cases they're 15, and they're, you know, usually but not always male. And really who I'm writing for is a smart person who has fairly broad-based interest in technology and ultimately wants to get technology to accomplish things in their life. In a lot of cases it's personal stuff like consuming entertainment, but in some cases it's also productivity. And there are some great sites that write for people who care a lot about clock speeds of processors and motherboards. You know, those are not the people I'm trying to reach. Mm-hmm. But I am trying to go deeper than a site like Gizmodo or Engadget, both of which I like, but they tend to do about two paragraphs on stuff. And I tend to write it on fewer topics at a little longer length. And ultimately I find that saying you're for a person of a given age or a given income level doesn't work for me because I find that there are all sorts of people who have this shared interest in technology, and I'm constantly fascinated to learn about some of my readers, and I will be talking to a reader at some length, and I'll discover that person is 16, and I had no idea until they told me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's kind of fascinating when you say, okay, I'm going to target this particular group, and then finding out later who you are pulling in to the web,
yeah.
You know, or the web that you've spun in terms of your space on the web. So, you know, it kind of relates in the sense that, you know, I really would love to get your take on where gaming units are. You talked about productivity. E3 has happened. And, you know, What's your take on, you know, I know you've been writing some articles recently, so, you know, you feel free to speak to those, but I am curious what your thoughts are on gaming units these days. I have the sense that there is, in terms of, you know, kind of relates to the demographic question for me, because there's this definite sense of, like, for example, my aunt thinks my husband's playing video games all day because we have, you know, all the different, you know, all the main gaming units out there, and we always have the new ones. But when in reality he's British and he downloads in real time from sites that allow you to either purchase or for content that doesn't have any licensing restriction, you can download for, you know, on torrent sites for free, you know, content that is, you know, basically British shows that show during the day. You download it while you're at your desk, and then we watch it in the evening together. So our life is very centered around these units as media units, even news units, because, you know, different like Rugby World Cup, different international sporting events, we tend to watch the UK coverage as well as the US coverage. Other people use, obviously, media servers and gaming units in different ways, and I'm just curious what you kind of see on the horizon in terms of usability and innovation in that area, because I think, you know, as I said, I think it's really underestimated by certain segments of the population, and I really think it's a more important area than most people realize.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, these consoles, they're all computers, and you've seen especially Microsoft and Sony really taking advantage of the fact that these devices are connected to the internet and to a TV, and they're really making them into media devices. Nintendo is not going in that direction as aggressively, but on the other hand, Nintendo has the most mainstream console there is in terms of gaming with the Wii, and I think they'll be pretty important because, you know, for the last 10 to 15 years, the industry has been trying to convince consumers to put a PC in their living room, and basically they have not had much success at all.
Right.
I still know very few people who have connected a personal computer to their TV in the living room, and there's really not much need to, because a device like a PlayStation 3 or an Xbox 360 really gives you what you need in order to do web stuff on the TV.
And entertainment stuff with Netflix, you know.
Yeah,
Netflix and
Amazon downloads. YouTube, and I think you'll see these devices get things like Hulu. And in some cases, you won't even need the console because you're starting to see TVs that have some fairly sophisticated access to internet media built right in.
And so, you know, of course, this is, you know, a personal question, so, you know, you don't have to answer it. But I always wonder about, you know, folks that cover technology. You know, you've shared with us what kind of mobile device you use. What do you have in your home? How do you consume television, or what other kinds of, you know, whatever other kinds of entertainment you like? Do you have gaming units? I envision you having probably just about everything. But, you know, what's in your main viewing area?
Well, it's constantly changing, and I do have all kinds of stuff. But, you know, in my living room, I still have Comcast. I think sometimes about trying to go internet only. But I have Comcast, and I have a TiVo, which has done a good job of adding things like Amazon and Netflix and other ways to get entertainment off of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a sling box so I can take all the TV I watch in the living room and also watch it on my laptop or my phone if I'm somewhere else. I have another TV in my house that I have an Apple TV connected to, and
mm-hmm.
I use that. And I also have the Roku box, which lets you watch stuff that you've bought from Amazon and also
mm-hmm.
gives you access to the Netflix on-demand service.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I also just use a laptop as a TV a lot of the time. I will watch Hulu or video podcasts on my laptop, which I sort of have with me almost all the time these days.
Yeah, I know there's this whole group of people that I know that, you know, have different names for, you know, it's like they almost give themselves this label, but they're Hulu onlys.
Mm-hmm.
I work with someone who has said, yeah, we're a Hulu only. when people are asking what they saw on television the night before. They have no television. They just use their PC. And we know for the millennial generation, there's that great story from Web 2.0 Expo, not this year, but the year before, with Clay Shirky talking in his in his address to us all about his little daughter when he got this brand new television and it was still wrapped up. I don't know if you were there or remember the story, but she came downstairs and saw the TV, and it was kind of at an angle because he was hooking everything up, and she went behind the TV, and he said she was really pulling on wires, trying to make things work or figure something out, and he couldn't figure out, but he didn't say anything. And she came out from behind the television at about, you know, 3 or 4 years old and said, "Where's the mouse?" And I love that story because I think it drives home, you know, where a lot of people are that are either early adopters or, you know, or just, you know, by age, they've just adapted to what's available online.
And there really is not that much difference in terms of technology or capability between a PC hooked up to a display and a TiVo or an Xbox or a PlayStation hooked up to a TV. They're really more alike than dissimilar at this point.
Yeah. Now, you were at TwitterCon, yeah?
Yes. I was not only at TwitterCon, but I can cheerfully take credit for the original idea, which I came up with, and then the folks at Modern Media grabbed it and ran with that and did about 95% of the work of making the event a success.
And I think that's so clever of you. I love it when good ideas get help with the implementation of them. And, you know, it was an amazing event in terms of both speakers and attendees. Wondering, you know, how the idea came about, if you can share that with us, and what you think the three most important, you know, either findings or developments or, you know, whatever the three big takeaways were for you from the event.
Sure. Well, I mean, the idea came up, I mean, really quite recently. It was about 2 months ago, and I was sitting around with my friend Gina Smith, who we've done some projects together, and we were talking about ideas for conferences because even when you're a media company as small as Technologizer, it makes sense to do conferences. They're a cool way to take advantage of what you do in a new world.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about ideas, and I said, well, what about a conference on Twitter for Business, which I think was a fairly obvious idea because, you know, everybody knows that there's a huge amount of interest in Twitter, and there are all these businesses who are attempting to figure out how to make use of it. And some of them, you know, some of them know what they're doing, and some of them don't know what they're doing, but know they don't know what they're doing or trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, they're, you know, doing a conference on Twitter is kind of obvious, and there are several other ones that either have just happened or are happening soon. And
it's happening virtually.
Yeah. And the key thing about ours was it was a little more focused. It was about Twitter for Business, and really the core parts of business we talked about were marketing and sales and customer service. And in terms of the findings from the conference, I mean, I think one key thing is that even if you do come from a marketing background, you can't just do marketing on Twitter. You know, ultimately it has to be kind of real, and it has to feel like, not only feel like it's done by real people, but actually be real, and you have to deal with the fact that some people on Twitter will be fans of your brand, and some of them will be very unhappy with you. Frank Eliason from Comcast was at TwitterCon.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sort of the inventor of doing customer service over Twitter, and he cheerfully deals with the fact that there are all these people on Twitter who, when they have problems with Comcast, rant and rave on Twitter, and he still deals with that and tries to help them, which I think is cool.
Yeah, I do too.
I think that's one major finding. You know, I think another major finding is we still don't know whether Twitter itself will be a major force forever, but I think most of the people at the conference kind of agree that if it's not Twitter, it'll be something like Twitter that will be popular moving forward, and it may just sort of become a core part of how we communicate with each other in the way that, you know, that in the 90s at first, a lot of people were on AOL doing AOL mail, and they could only communicate with other AOL users.
Oh,
and
I remember that era so well.
So those are two of the key things I think we all agreed on. And I think we also agreed There's a lot about Twitter that is still kind of mysterious. We talked a little bit about whether they have a business model, and we actually had a guest from Twitter who I think really talked about the fact that I think their main focus on looking for revenue is not advertising or charging users. It's providing companies who use Twitter with more powerful tools to reach people and maybe charging for those.
So maybe that would be akin to kind of the LinkedIn model.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, he wasn't terribly specific, but a number of the companies that exhibited at TwitterCon, you know, provide dashboards so that if you are a company on Twitter, you can track everything that people are saying about you and assign tweets to people within your company and make sure you follow through. And it sounded like maybe some of that stuff at some point will be built into Twitter. And they might also allow companies to have verified Twitter names so you don't have to wonder whether a particular Twitter account really is from the company it claims to be from.
Wouldn't that be great? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't know if you do have a complaint and you do want to address it on Twitter, you don't know whether the handle is, you know, where it comes from. So
right.
It reminds me of the early days of the wild, wild west of the .coms when the same kind of thing was happening. There was a lot of squatting going on and then people putting together faux sites, in their free time. Always wondering about, you know, how people have free time to do these things. But in any event, it happens. So I think that's, you know, it just so reminds me, and I'm kind of almost trying to put my head around what I was thinking at that time. So, you know, like going back to 1999 is one of the years that I was working at a startup and doing the whole pre-bust first time work and, you know, what it was like and, you know, who the players were and thinking about so many of the companies that went out of business and why. And, you know, the question of the business model always seems to come up. So I think that's interesting. And I'm so glad you shared that with us because I think that's an important thing to think about. I want to just welcome those that might be joining us now on Breakthrough the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. We are chatting right now with Harry McCracken of Technologizer, and I welcome you to Twitter in with questions at eastwick.com. More questions from some of the folks that contributed. Somebody tweeted in, who's your favorite, or I'm sorry, this is from Kimberly from our staff. Who is your favorite interviewee and why?
My favorite person to interview?
Yes.
I'm not sure if I have a specific one, but I do know that as a journalist, it is pretty much really challenging to find people in the industry who really are kind of straightforward and honest and who don't lapse into marketing ease. And I always find it really refreshing when people are up front and tackle difficult questions and answer them in a straightforward way. I think that ultimately buys companies a lot more credibility if they're willing to do that.
Can you think of companies that, you know, you've been particularly surprised at their, you know, at maybe being impressed by their level of openness and straightforwardness that you can talk to?
I think in general, companies are kind of learning that they need to do this. I mean, actually, one person who leaps to mind who I think has sort of stepped out of the industry but is a great guy is a guy named Gregor Freund, who was the founder of Zone Labs, which became part of Checkpoint Software. And, you know, I don't think he could be, he could not lapse into marketing ease if his life depended on it. He was always very, very refreshingly honest about when their products had problems, he would admit that. When they weren't everything they could be, he would admit that. And therefore, we tended to go to him for quotes more than some people just because we knew he would give us stuff that was good. And I think it's really important, especially on the web, because on the web, if you know, your problems will be talked about in public by everybody who knows about it. And ignoring that is kind of not an option. You need to confront it and be straightforward about it. And if you admit problems rather than covering them up or ignoring them, I think you ultimately have more credibility.
Mm-hmm. I think that's you know, obviously very true as, you know, someone who comes from a journalism background and is doing new media for an agency. Obviously, I'm, you know, I see myself as the champion of, as, you know, much, you know, as coaching companies, training companies, hopefully helping companies put their arms around, heads around, heart around the idea of transparency and sharing and, you know, being advocates for their own customer base, which they feel they've been, but maybe don't look like they've been online. So, mm-hmm. you know, really trying to help them make that happen. And, you know, technology is a big piece of that, you know, in terms of, you know, teaching them, as you said, you know, companies coming out with dashboards and other ways to help them listen and assign and make sure that people know, you know, kind of what the on-the-ground message is at any given point. And so, you know, I go through, you know, I monitor myself and I go through lots of tweets every day and lots of blog posts and comments to see, you know, if there's a crisis happening and, you know, one of our companies may not readily realize it because they're not necessarily listening themselves. Is there any company that you think of, you know, I think there's so many examples. I mean, you mentioned Comcast earlier of companies that are doing a good job on Twitter in particular. But another area I think that kind of goes unnoticed a little bit is commenting, you know, mm-hmm. whether it be on blogs or specifically on social networks like LinkedIn. We have a lot of B2B clients, so LinkedIn plays a significant role in some of the strategies that we recommend as one of the tools that companies can use to connect with people that are using their products who may be having issues or trouble. So, I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, in terms of, you know, companies, I mean, is it something that you look at, first of all? And I guess, second of all, if you do, do you see any companies doing that well or maybe just holistically monitoring the web really well?
I think Dell leaps to mind as a company that got off to a rocky start with that, but at least today their heart is in the right place and they're doing a pretty good job of trying to keep tabs on what people are saying about Dell and to respond and to attempt to help when they can. Hewlett-Packard also leaps to mind as a company that's trying to do that, and I think it's awfully hard to do because there'll just be so many issues on any given day with the products of companies as large as those, and hopefully they're not just responding to well-known bloggers who will make a stink if they have a problem. Hopefully they're also responding just to everyday people who might be reporting problems in a personal blog or in comments. I think another key thing is to have things like message forums on your own site as a company and try to make those pretty open. I visited Symantec earlier this week, and just around a year ago, they launched, you know, support forums on their site for their Norton products, and they're doing a good job of making these forums a place where people can speak openly and you know, not only get help from Symantec, but also help each other because, you know, the best brands have these people who are advocates for the brands, and in fact, a lot of the support on the Symantec forums are provided by people who don't get a nickel for what they do, but who are passionate about, you know, products like Norton Internet Suite, and just spend a lot of their free time helping other people, and even when they're helping people who have major frustrating problems, it's better that happen on the Symantec site than somewhere else where Symantec has no control over it.
I could not agree more. In fact, Dell is a company that's worked with a company that I happen to know someone from. We interviewed early on this podcast a company called Bunchball. I'm not sure if you're familiar with their product, mm-hmm. but are you familiar with kind of how they work?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so they're for those that are listening that may not be aware or have listened to that podcast, they basically provide incentive programs and some insight for companies about how the community is operating. So, for example, one of the things that they talked with Dell about is one particular person who had answered 20,000 plus support questions within their forums, within their communities, on the Dell site correctly, and was clearly seen as someone who, I mean, you know, when Dell's calculating how much customer service time and energy they had saved from this one man, it's pretty incredible to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, within these communities, I think the next phase has to be the kind of thing that Bunchball is doing as their core business, which is creating incentives and recognition around those in the community that are doing a great job, not just because, you know, they're saving the company money potentially, but hopefully also because they are brand champions. They're the kind of people you want to say thank you to in some way. I'm curious if you know, what your take is on that piece of it, you know, kind of looking at the psychology of those in user forums, going deeper, and any other companies you think that are providing solutions for companies to tap into the idea of incentivizing community, recognizing community members, to hopefully continue a deeper engagement with those that are participating.
Well, you know, people do this in fact part because it's fun to be recognized as an expert. It's fun to help other people. It makes people feel good. But I do think it makes sense for companies to try to figure out how to encourage that to happen. I know Symantec, you know, will name people as sort of official support experts. I'm trying to think if I know of any companies that are helping to make that easy, and I'm not sure if I know of any off the top of my head, but I do think it's key, and it's, you know, it doesn't necessarily even involve things like money. It may, in some cases, recognizing them. And I know that the folks within Symantec who run these forums, you know, have a large amount of respect for these volunteers and in some ways treat them like peers, which makes sense because the smartest amateurs know at least as much about these products as the people who work at the companies that make them, and sometimes more than they do. Somebody who's passionate about Norton's products will probably do a better job of supporting them than a garden variety customer support rep who's new in the job and doesn't have the depth of knowledge.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely think. I mean, personally, I'm a huge fan of what Bunchball has been able to achieve. They've also worked with, and this is not meant to be a promo for them, but I think it's really, really important personally to take that engagement to the next level and not ignore. I think we have a couple of open source clients who have done a great job of even providing tools and other things to community members, but aren't specifically necessarily looking at, you know, kind of the fundamental things that make us tick as people, and recognition being one of them, and responding to that in some way that, you know, using the SaaS solution that Bunchball provides, and I'm sure that there are other companies, but knowing a bit about their solution, you know, I think they, or whether you build it yourself, it's you know, I think that's going to be increasingly important, because I think more of that interaction is going to, it's going to, I think as people continue to translate what, you know, have been activities that we did by phone, if we had to call customer support or even through chat, as it becomes more of a peer-focused activity, or you can get your answers more quickly from peers, so you look to them just as much as you look to actual support reps, you know, recognition is going to be a huge piece of that, I think, no matter how you look at that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some of the other things that, you know, I think are really valuable to talk to you about, given the years of experience that you have and having had the ability to really focus so much time and attention on just, you know, a few places, you know, obviously going deep with technology and being able to really be an expert. You know, one of the questions that my colleague Lita had was, you know, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen in the Valley, let's say in the past 5 years?
Well, I think the single biggest change over the last few years is that it's possible to do really interesting things without a lot of resources or a lot of people. I mean, when I think about, you know, the Web 1.0 world, it was full of companies like WebVan that spent hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars hiring thousands of people and building warehouses and building custom software, you know, before they could ever make a nickel. And in retrospect, it is not surprising that a lot of those companies cratered. And when you look at some of the coolest companies today, there are so many factors that make it easier to do this stuff without a lot of money. I mean, open source has been huge in terms of making interesting things possible. Twitter, I believe, has something like 35 employees. It's the hottest company there is, and it's still a small business. And I think that's really important because even though we are in a tough time for the Valley, you know, you're not seeing a lot of companies that are doing interesting things that deserve to live, just going out of business for the most part. They're hanging in there, and that's possible only because they're kind of meaner and leaner in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Any other changes that you see that, you know, I mean, maybe the least shocking and most shocking development that you wrote a story about?
I mean, let's see, other big changes. You know, we live in a world of web services, which was not true in the late 90s or even 5 years ago. And Twitter is not primarily a destination site. It's really a platform. And a lot of the interesting sites are like that. Facebook is a platform. Technologizer is a content site, but even a little guy like me needs to think about the world beyond what I do and to try to be part of it. And I think most of the interesting things you'll see are that way. It's one of the challenges right now is I think it's awfully tough to be a small hardware company and do well. And that, you know, there actually are quite a few companies that made interesting gadgets who have not been able to make it, because with gadgets you still actually do need to have considerable resources and manufacture stuff and distribute it, and that challenge is not going away. So it's
Can you give us a few examples on that, on the gadget front?
Sure. I mean, one that leaps to mind is a company called Dash, which made this really cool GPS unit, which had a cellular connection, and each Dash GPS handheld talked to all the other ones so that it had live information about traffic patterns that you usually don't get with GPS. And it was really well done. They made a really neat product. And within a few months of releasing it, they realized that they should not be selling the device, and they said they were going to try to license their technology to other companies instead. And I heard a rumor the other day that maybe RIM has bought them, although that hasn't been confirmed. But it's really hard to be a small company that makes one device. Akimbo also leaps to mind. They made a box for the living room that was kind of neat. They were actually sort of the first people to do it, a living room internet TV box, and they didn't make it either. Ugobi, which made the Pleo dinosaur, also didn't make it. Hardware is hard to do unless you're a larger company. And getting stuff into retail is increasingly hard to do, especially as you've seen this major shakeout in which a lot of the electronics retailers are no longer with us. And
yeah,
you really do
absolutely.
You do need to figure out how to get into the Best Buy and Walmart and Target. And if you can't do that, it's hard to go anywhere.
And I, you know, for me, I think that, you know, also the, you know, e-commerce platforms needing to be more flexible and integratable into things like Twitter and Facebook is something that we're going to see in the future. You know, I think increasingly people like myself, I avoid going to a store at all costs, mostly because I don't have to. I remember Adam Metz wrote a blog post once about, you know, with Amazon Prime, he basically does all his grocery shopping on the web, which I find a little challenging because, you know, I'm fueled basically by Diet Coke, and you can't really get that on the through Amazon, at least with the Prime shipping. So, you know, it's kind of funny that he would make that example. But, I mean, I was a web van user back in the day, and, you know, I'm kind of always appalled at, you know, the big name supermarkets like Safeway, and you know, constantly being out of items, or the customers, you know, the people that arrive at your doorstep are, for me at least, have always been really nice. But, you know, it's like that the convenience of the web doesn't always translate when they come and they've bagged everything and you, you know, or bagged things that didn't need to be bagged. And for someone like me who's obsessive about not using plastic bags, you know, it's like, why did you have a handle? You don't need a, you know, things like that, that, you know, it's like just providing that extra level of a checkbox if you want things to come bagged, or you can just take them out of the box yourself or something like that.
Groceries,
you know,
are tough to do, and I mean, it's a business where the margins are razor thin.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
So nobody, I mean, Webvan figured out how to do groceries well, but it was just too expensive to sustain. And I think nobody figured out how to do it in a way that makes sense financially.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope that more stores are able to do that. You know, I think it's, you know, it's one of the things that's kind of like the basic translation of web to, you know, basic e-commerce. You know, we have to eat. So, you know, it could be a really, you would think it would be really successful. But as you say, you know, the logistics of it are kind of a nightmare in terms of distribution, you know, where are the facilities versus where are the people living, et cetera. But I want to make sure that, you know, we only have a few minutes left. I don't go without asking you something that Melissa, one of our senior staff, asked, which is hearing about the trends that you're following right now, and then maybe a separate category, those that you're really interested in. I think we've touched on some of them, but definitely what you're following would be interesting to hear about.
I mean, I think the fact that that all these tech products that used to be quite distinct are all part of one big world is key. You're seeing almost everything becoming a computing device. I mean, you know, we already talked about the fact that game consoles are computing devices and phones are computing devices, but you're also seeing things, almost every product getting on the internet directly. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at the all-in-one printer in my home office. And that sits on the internet. That sits on the internet and can be controlled from the internet. You're seeing digital cameras that have Wi-Fi connections and have built-in GPS. When everything is a computer and everything is on the internet, some really interesting things happen, and we're just starting to scratch that. And really, just even a few years ago, these were distinct categories of products that didn't talk to each other, and that's all changing. I think that you know, another interesting thing is the Kindle has sold pretty well, but I think it's really just sort of the first e-reader that's good enough to criticize, and you'll see other devices in that form factor, and I'm hoping for screen technologies that make them more appealing, because the Kindle has unbelievable battery life. You can run it for weeks without turning it off, but to me the screen is still not that great. And I'm hoping for stuff that has good color and is really easy to read and has long battery life, and there's some sign those technologies will come along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, clearly battery life is one of those topics that you can't go without talking about if you've gone to a conference anytime recently and seen all of the cords everywhere, and those of us looking for sockets, like, you know, it's our own personal lifeline. You know, it is impressive when a product does have great battery life. Any other trends that you're following or that you would expect to, you know, really go mainstream?
I mean, one of the other things I'm covering a lot, which I, you know, a few years ago I would have said was a dead topic, is browsers. I mean,
really?
It wasn't all that long ago that Internet Explorer had 95% market share. But we have this really healthy competition going on. Excuse me. between Microsoft and Mozilla and Google and Apple and Opera and little guys like Flock. And it's
Camino.
Really important. Yeah, Camino. It's really important because the browser is the platform for web-based applications, and they need to get faster and more reliable and more versatile and more secure to make that happen. And if we were still in a world where we're IE dominated, it would not happen. And so that's a beat that was fascinating in 1995 and then became really boring, but it's a strong beat again today. In terms of things that are becoming more mainstream, I think people are finally getting interested in sustainability and whether products are green or not, and I think you'll see more and more interest in that. And hopefully companies will not just make a lot of noise about their products being sustainable, but actually do things to make them part of good citizenship.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll start to see organizations that seal products with a stamp of approval that we actually can recognize? So I think that's one of the things I see is kind of a missing link in the green tech movement is, groups or organizations that you trust potentially recommending products, but, kind of like USDA organic versus, there's three or four different organic seals of approval. Same thing with green. Are we going to have this splintering of, how green it really is? And are there going to be organizations that pop up to kind of monitor that from a more, not almost a regulatory perspective?
I mean, you're seeing some of that already, but there's no seal of approval yet that's even as well known as something like Energy Star is, and I think you'll see that happen, and you might see regulatory stuff happen too. I mean, as of right now, most of it is kind of voluntary, but I don't know if that's going to last forever.
Yeah, I think that's an important piece of the puzzle, because obviously if people are compelled to do things because they have to or can earn something like a seal of approval, then obviously, I think it just ups the ante in terms of incentive, which makes me, wonder, who do you think are the unsung heroes of the green movement right now? Products that are very green but maybe don't get the credit for it that they should.
Good question. I think that I think companies that make notebooks are at least moving in the right direction, and then almost everybody who makes notebooks is at least doing some stuff. And you're seeing Apple be really aggressive about doing everything they can to make their products sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
I think almost everybody is an unsung hero at this point, because with the possible with the possible exception of Apple, there aren't companies that leap to mind as being associated with this. And I know that there are companies like HP who have done a lot with printer consumables to try to make it easy for people to recycle them, which is really important, because if you use a printer, you end up with a lot of waste materials.
Absolutely.
Which historically people tossed in the trash. And HP, I know, has dedicated quite a bit of effort to recycling those, and it's doing a lot of the recycling itself, and is giving people things like boxes they can toss a toner cartridge into and ship back.
Yeah, I so wish that people would, battery manufacturers particularly, would do that, because I find that the most frustrating thing in the world. I'm like, okay, does this actually go into a bin, or do I put it to the side?
Mm-hmm.
What do I do with these old batteries, whether they be lithium batteries that I've replaced or even just everyday batteries that go in the remotes to the various things that we control? But Harry, I know you're on the mend from having the flu, and we're just about wrapping up, and I want to thank you so much for your, as I said, jumping in to pinch hit, and it's been fascinating talking with you. You're someone I will definitely call on again, so look for my emails if I have questions
related. Anytime, Jennifer. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, so I want to thank the audience as well for tuning in to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Next week, we're doing two shows for you. On Tuesday, our guest will be Mario Sundar of LinkedIn, and on Friday, Tom Foremski of Silicon Valley Watcher. As always, you can keep up with us and the latest on this show and Eastwick in general at blogs.eastwick.com, as well as getting links to Harry's website, Technologizer. If you haven't seen it, you must go to it. And I wish everybody a happy weekend. Bye-bye.